This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 23, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Another assault by US troops begins in Iraq. We get the latest, plus an update on the recovery efforts in Fallujah. We examine what the new federal budget means for the nation's poor. And could there be a people's victory for the environment against Bush's attempt to end roadless areas of the wilderness? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Ukrainian opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko took the presidential oath today in a symbolic move, then waved to hundreds of thousands of his supporters in a Kiev square. Ukrainians continued to march for a second day on the parliament. Today's line stretched 2 miles out from the parliamentary steps and continues to grow. International election observers from the European Union and the United States said yesterday that the current government rigged the elections in their favor. But outgoing President Kuchma said in a prepared press notice that such critical statements could lead to a deterioration of the situation in the Ukraine, implying civil war. Lawmakers in the nation's parliament were unable to gain a quorum to move on a no-confidence vote and declare the elections invalid. While exit polling showed Yushchenko winning, official government results declared current Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych the winner. Russian leaders also back Yanukovych. The United Nations report on global HIV/AIDS shows that women are becoming infected at an alarmingly high rate. Ellen Ratner has more.
The AIDS epidemic is on the rise, especially among women, according to the 2004 UN AIDS Epidemic Update report. UN AIDS Director Dr. Peter Piot cites sexual violence as a reason for the upsurge.
The report highlights the need to address sexual violence, which is particularly affecting women, and where we see a direct link between this violence and death through AIDS.
The report found a striking rise in the amount of women infected with HIV. In the United States, AIDS ranks among the top three causes of death in African American women aged 35 to 44. The report concludes that a record 40 million people carry HIV today, despite the $6 billion worldwide effort to fight the disease in 2003. Dr. Piot claims that doubling current financial support and expanding existing prevention programs is necessary to gain the upper hand in the epidemic. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner.
The European Union announced the formation of a new army capable of deployment anywhere in the world on short notice, independent of NATO, the UN, and other regional groups. Patrick Beckett has more from Copenhagen.
The Rapid Reaction Forces will be composed of 13 separate units of 1,500 troops each. Each unit will be directed by the government of the member country from which the troops are provided. The first unit will be operational by the end of 2005 and can be rapidly deployed anywhere in the world. Only Britain and France are currently prepared to coordinate such groups, but Italy and Spain are expected to follow suit, and other European countries are promising to contribute troops to the remaining battle groups. The idea of European troops outside the framework of NATO has been controversial both in Europe and Washington, with critics saying it is essentially the formation of a European army. The idea of a unified European military was proposed by Britain and France at a European summit in 1998, but initial targets were never reached. European troops are already poised to take over military operations in Bosnia and have in the past conducted policing missions in Macedonia and Eastern Congo. From Copenhagen, Patrick Beckett, Free Speech Radio News.
More than half of all hate crimes, more than 7,400 in the United States during the year 2003, were directed at African Americans, according to an FBI report. The statistics are a compilation of hate crimes as reported by barely 16% of law enforcement agencies nationwide. Other human rights analysts say that many hate crimes go unreported because the victims fear more attacks by the perpetrators, agents of the government, or concern over their immigration status. And the U.S. government's enforcement of civil rights laws is declining, according to another just-released report. Darby Hickey has more from D.C.
During the last 4 years, there has been a steady decline of enforcement of civil rights laws. However, complaints have remained at a steady level, according to a nonpartisan research center at Syracuse University in New York. Their report shows that while the number of charges for civil rights violations dropped, government agencies sharply increased prosecution for immigration and terrorism-related cases. Arsalan Iftikhar of the Council on American-Islamic Relations says the decline comes as no surprise and reflects the government's priorities.
What American Muslims and Arabs are going through today really is not much different than what a lot of minorities have gone through in the 20th century here in America. We just wish that our Justice Department would allocate more resources and more interest in actually prosecuting the people who violate federal civil rights and hate crimes laws as they do for people who are violating minor civil immigration violations.
Only 5% of civil rights complaints were prosecuted in 2003. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
An international conference on the future of Iraq ended today in Egypt. While there was not much criticism of the US invasion of Iraq, Syria was the lone nation to express its outrage. The rest of the Arab League and the G8 nations gave their support for Iraqi elections to take place as scheduled on January 30. Meanwhile, in Iraq, US, British and Iraqi troops began another assault this morning, this time on the town of Jabella, just south of Baghdad. Many arrests were made, but casualty reports have not yet been given. And as the cleanup of Fallujah continues, FSRN correspondents Dar Jamil and Salam Talib bring us the latest from Baghdad.
In Baghdad, car bombs continue to detonate into Iraqi police stations and U.S. military patrols on a daily basis. Persons with links to the U.S.-installed interim government are assassinated every week as the infrastructure in Iraq's capital city remains in shambles, 19 months into the occupation. Last week, Prime Minister Ayed Alawi, speaking on the Al Arabiya television network, blamed the media in Iraq for failing to cover the real situation in Fallujah. Alawi accused journalists for reporting the story from outside of Fallujah. He also accused journalists for being inaccurate in their descriptions of the atrocities which occurred in the city. Alawi added that any journalist would have been granted the opportunity to embed with the U.S. military inside the embattled city. A French freelance photographer, Corentin Fleury, was detained by the U.S. military along with his interpreter, 28-year-old Bakhtiar Abdullah Haddad, when they were exiting Fallujah just before the current siege of the city began. They had worked inside the city, documenting life there during the lead-up to the U.S. attack. Fleury was released after 5 days of interrogations by the U.S. military, but his interpreter remains detained.
No, I've been trying to find some information for the last 5 days, but I've had no information of any side. I've been calling the Red Cross, the Marines. The French embassy is trying to get him out also. Journalists that I've been working with him for the last 2 years are sending letters confirming that he's a translator and he has no link with any kind of militia or insurgents group. We are just trying to get him out.
Alawi has now stated that the people of Fallujah would soon return to their city. He added that Fallujah would be rebuilt the same way Sadr City and Najaf had been after fierce battles between members of the Shia resistance and U.S. soldiers left both cities in ruin. A Free Speech Radio news correspondent failed to find evidence of any reconstruction in Sadr City, so he asked Uday Al-Sadi, a man who lives in Sadr City.
The destruction in Fallujah, Najaf, and Sadr City is the same, and they all need rehabilitation. This is the only true thing the government has said. But when they say rebuilding for the government, this usually means something far from reality. If anyone tours Sadr City and sees the markets and streets, they see the destruction, but nothing of rehabilitation. No new streets, no new schools. No compensation for people whose houses or shops have been destroyed. The Americans destroyed everything, and you cannot see any progress in the city. We know it takes more than a day to fix, but we also know it needs a beginning, and that beginning has not come yet.
John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador for Iraq, announced last week that the battle in Fallujah stands as a lesson for resistance fighters everywhere. Fighting rages throughout Iraq as well as parts of Fallujah, as U.S. soldiers are killed or wounded every day. Daily attacks on the U.S. military have more than doubled since the start of the Fallujah offensive. In one day alone here in Baghdad, U.S. forces were attacked 66 times. Like Ayed Alawi, Negroponte has also promised to rebuild Fallujah, just as Sadr City and Najaf had been successfully rebuilt. Today, the streets of Sadr City are filled with lakes of sewage. The putrid green water has filled nearby homes, as well as seeped into the drinking water. In Najaf, the rubble of buildings destroyed by tanks remains untouched. Houses whose walls bear hundreds of pockmarks left by bullets stand amidst garbage-strewn streets as a terrible reminder of the fierce clashes last summer. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dar Jamail with Salam Talib in Baghdad, Iraq.
Congress has eliminated funding for President Bush's program to research the development of low-yield nuclear weapons such as bunker busters in the omnibus spending bill passed last Saturday. Arms control advocates praise Republican Representative David Hobson for helping strip the administration's $27 million request out of the budget. Bush administration officials have expressed interest in using such weapons on the battlefield. However, the federal budget is not faring so well for the poor. Poverty-based programs have either been cut or not adjusted to keep pace with inflation. And as Mitch Jeserich reports from Washington, D.C., advocates for low-income communities worry that this is just the beginning.
When debating the budget bill on Saturday in the House of Representatives, Republican lawmaker after Republican lawmaker praised their achievement of a fiscal plan that freezes spending in almost every department besides the military.
That it achieves a freeze or a 0% growth in non-defense discretionary spending. That's a historic accomplishment, an extraordinary accomplishment.
This bill actually freezes non-defense, non-homeland security. The first time we've done that since 1996.
But if the Pentagon's budget of over $400 billion is added to the federal fiscal plan, which it officially is, then the government is still spending much more than it is taking in, leading to the ever-increasing budget deficit. And while the 2005 budget does little to cut into that deficit, social services are going to be hit hard with budget cuts.
And I'm certain that my Republican friends will come down to the floor, pat each other on the back, and proclaim this giant $388.4 billion spending bill a great success.
Democratic Representative Martin Frost of Texas.
Their policies and mismanagement have sent the budget deficit skyrocketing from $159 billion in fiscal year 2002 to a record $422 billion today. And just this week forced Congress to raise the debt limit by $800 billion, saddling our children with a massive debt that they cannot afford.
The 2005 budget makes a 0.8% cut to all departments besides the Department of Homeland Security and Defense. But taking into account both inflation and an increase of population, Richard Corgan with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says reductions in social programs are much deeper.
The total level of funding for those programs appear to be down by 3% or maybe just a little bit more.
With the Bush administration's tax-cutting policies, Bob Greenstein, also with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, says the plan to rein in the federal deficit lacks a sense of shared sacrifice.
Continued advances, particularly on the revenue side, of further tax reductions, often for those with the most means or the most lobbying clout or the biggest campaign contributions, alongside a beginning of squeezing of some important supports for some of the poorest people in the country.
The No Child Left Behind Act is funded almost at the same level as last year, which is not likely to please education advocates who commonly say the act has been habitually underfunded. Getting hit the hardest in education is Title I funding for special education. Also, Congress failed to enact a provision that would stop the Department of Education from making deep cuts in Pell Grants and other financial aid programs. The Department of Housing and Urban Development will see a 3-5% cut after inflation to its programs. Linda Couch, Deputy Director of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, fears that many people will lose housing in the next year, as the distribution of housing vouchers will increase in some areas but decrease in others.
While we've seen the budget for housing programs go down in recent years, this is really the first year that there's been an affirmative step to take housing away from people who currently have it. In the past, we've seen sort of the scale back of programs that would have produced new units for new families. This bill, I think it can be fairly said, may indeed end up taking housing assistance away from those who already have it.
For the fourth straight year, funds for child care assistance programs have been frozen because neither inflation nor wages for child care workers stayed the same during that time. Some economists equate the four-year freeze on such spending as a 7.4% cut, potentially eliminating 40,000 children from the program. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
When President Bush came to office in 2001, the economy was in a recession, but held a $5.6 billion surplus. Now the United States is in a $436 billion budget deficit. Economists say the nation's economic woes are compounded by President Bush's major economic policies of tax cuts to the wealthy, free trade, and his energy policies. Unions say that workers have borne the brunt of these policies. President Bush faces his new term with the worst unemployment record of any administration since the Great Depression. Pauline Bartolone reports.
This tax relief was the largest in a generation, and it gave the economy a boost just at the right time, ensuring that the recession was one of the shortest and shallowest in modern American history.
In January 2003, President George W. Bush announced an ambitious fiscal recovery plan. His strategy was to launch major tax cuts to free consumer spending and jumpstart the economy. However, the nation's job sector is hardly showing signs of recovery. The nation suffers a net loss of 600,000 jobs since Bush's inauguration. The president, however, says his tax cuts have pulled the U.S. out of a recession. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
The economy always comes out of a recession. It does it by itself. So saying you pulled the nation's economy out of a recession is a bit like sitting around in June saying that you ended the winter. So the appropriate question that anyone would ask is, you know, well, how is the economy doing? How has the recovery from this recession been? And by any measure, it's been awful. I mean, we continue to see rising poverty rates, declining levels of health insurance coverage, and declining real wages.
Times are tough even for those with jobs in the U.S. Wages have been stagnant under the Bush administration. Outsourcing expands, and new overtime rules disclude millions of workers from overtime security. Economist Ellen Frank says the Bush administration's tax cuts have not been employment-driven.
There's no question that for people in the bottom 50% of the income distribution, their income security has gotten worse. Median income was stagnant, according to the last census report, which covers data up to 2003. And that means that even though, you know, people were working more hours, more and more families are sending more family members into the workforce, they haven't been able to increase their incomes because the average wage is under such pressure.
During his administration, Bush's three major tax cut initiatives saved the top 1% of U.S. taxpayers nearly $200 billion, an average of $78,000 each. The average tax cut to each middle-income earner was only $1,000. Dean Baker says if the tax cuts were geared towards creating demand, they would have stimulated the economy and created jobs.
Which would have meant orienting them towards lower-income people who would spend the money. Instead, they oriented towards the wealthiest people who, you know, spent some, saved some, but the long and short of it is it didn't create as much demand in the economy, didn't lead to the sort of investment that you know, was promised. So the tax cuts seem to have been an effective way to have redistributed income upwards from, you know, those at the bottom and middle. But in terms of, you know, leading to new investment, new jobs, we just don't see it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
President Bush's plan to revise a Clinton-era rule for roadless areas of national forests may have hit a snag. The public comment period recently ended on the Bush plan to let governors decide if they want their state's roadless areas protected from logging and mining. A staffer for Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington reported 95% of 1.3 million comments are opposed. Lee Robardis of KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, has more.
The Clinton roadless plan would impact about one-third of all acreage in national forests, 58 million acres, much of it in rugged terrain at high elevations. A successful lawsuit brought by several states ruled that despite millions of comments and 600 public hearings, Forest Service public outreach had been inadequate, and the Bush administration sought to amend the rule. They proposed giving governors 18 months to opt in to a protection plan, and it's that idea that got a thumbs down from an estimated 95% of the 1.3 million who commented. Gary McFarlane of the Idaho Conservation Group Friends of the Clearwater expects Bush to ignore public sentiment.
I'd hope they would listen to the will of the American people, but given what this administration has done in the past, I'm not very encouraged.
McFarlane says if the Bush plan takes effect, species that Americans care about and treaty obligations like those with the nearby Nez Perce tribe will be extremely threatened.
It's going to mean much more litigation. It's going to be much more contention on the national forests. And there's going to be a lot of anger from citizens seeing the last few vestiges of our wild forests be put under the saw.
However, most Western governors, Democrats and Republicans alike, are against the plan, with only Idaho's Dirk Kempthorne speaking in favor. Wyoming Governor Dave Freudenthal called the proposed policy a cosmetic attempt to shift the Forest Service's responsibility for land use planning to the state without shifting any authority or funding to see the plans implemented. That doesn't sit well with timber industry interests, Chris West of the American Forest Resource Council.
It's ironic to hear several governors out there saying that they don't want to do this, but when it comes to welfare or immigration or a whole host of other national public policy issues, they want state rights.
West says roadless areas need logging because most of the land destroyed by catastrophic fires in the last 5 years has been in those areas. But destroyed is the wrong word for Grant Meyer of the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of New Mexico. Meyer, who recently co-authored a new study on fire regimes in the West, says while many recognize that cool ground fires sometimes help regenerate vegetation, science doesn't yet know enough about the long-term effects of catastrophic fires, which by definition immolate entire trees.
It's pretty clear from the studies that were done in Yellowstone after the 1988 fires that some of the kinds of severely negative effects that people might have anticipated just did not come to pass. The effects in erosion and sedimentation and streams are quite transient in that environment, certainly.
Tom Uniak of the Washington Wilderness Association says the Bush administration has been served a mandate to protect the nearly 58 million roadless Forest Service acres nationwide from development, including 2 million acres in his home state.
These roadless areas preserve safe and clean drinking water for more than 60 million Americans. They protect wildlife habitat for over 1,600 threatened and endangered species, and they protect the quality of life that so many people enjoy being close to forests.
The Forest Service will review the public comments and announce a decision in December or January. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis.
Around 200 protesters from the Transform Columbus Day Alliance were in court in Denver last week. They were at the arraignment, which stemmed from their arrest at the Columbus Day demonstrations in October. Maeve Conran looks at their case in light of the upcoming protests this coming Thanksgiving weekend.
On October 9th, hundreds of people marched in downtown Denver in protest of the Columbus Day Parade, something they see as a celebration of genocide and colonialism. The Transform Columbus Day Alliance, which organized the demonstration, is a coalition of about 80 groups who are trying to abolish the Columbus Day holiday.
Columbus Day has got to go!
More than 200 people were arrested as they sat down in the street in an attempt to block the parade. They were arrested and charged with loitering and disobeying a lawful order. 134 of them were arraigned last Friday, with the remainder being heard this week. The majority of the defendants are pleading not guilty to the charges. Adrienne Benavides, one of the group's defense attorneys.
The defendants are, from what when we've talked to them, they didn't do anything wrong by attempting to block the parade, that they were making a statement against genocide, against hate speech.
In an unusual move, the courts are arraigning the minors along with the adults.
Yeah, usually the juveniles are heard in a court that just works with juveniles. It's unusual, but it's not extraordinary that they would be in another courtroom because the charges are the same, whether they're juvenile or an adult.
No trial date has so far been set, and the remaining defendants are set to be arraigned this Friday. One of those who will appear in court on Friday is Glenn Morris, a leader in the Colorado American Indian Movement. Glenn has been a long-standing critic of the Columbus Day celebration and says that the group will not stop demonstrating until holidays like Columbus Day are no longer celebrated.
After 100 years of a hate-filled holiday, it's time for the city of Denver to transcend that to transform that and to really create a new model, a new vision for the future for all of our children, not just for Indigenous children, but for all of our children.
For Free Speech Radio News in Colorado, this is Maeve Conran.
This past weekend, local community members in LA's Central West District protested outside a large lot of now fenced up land, which is a historic train yard recently purchased by Meta Housing Corporation. For the past 20 years, the lot, known by neighborhood residents as the Belmont Tunnel, has been an unofficial park to graffiti artists and immigrants who play a pre-Columbian ball game there. Although Meta Housing has not secured the permits to start demolishing the historic site, they illegally started demolition on the site last week, starting a gentrification plan that critics say is sure to displace the hundreds of people who've enjoyed Belmont for decades. Aura Bogado has the story.
Photographer Ben Higa stares through a chain-link fence at what used to be the Belmont Yard. Like many people, he's been coming here for years, using one of the last open cultural spaces in L.A.
I've been coming to the Belmont Tunnel, what the neighborhood kids call the Belmont Tunnel, which is the old Toluca train yard for the red car since the 1980s, when it's become a sort of unofficial public park slash graffiti art yard. This is probably the last remaining one, the last graffiti yard that is this huge and large with this scale of walls.
Besides the graffiti writers that started painting here in 1984, Belmont has been home to recent immigrants from the Mexican states of Guerrero and Michoacán who play an indigenous ball game there called Pelota Tarasca. Magdaleno Hernandez started coming to the weekly Tarasca games over 10 years ago. He usually drives an hour on Sundays just to watch the game and meet with friends after a long week's work. Hernandez says that Belmont provided one of the only spaces in L.A. where players could create a network for the immigrant community.
Because we don't have anyone's support, anyone who will grant us a piece of land so that we can play without apprehension, where the police won't bother us. Because you see, the police bother us when they see the ball game and they start saying, "Hey, what are you doing?" And all we're doing is playing, and they remove us.
Belmont is located in the heart of LA's Central West District. And although the zone is already the city's most densely populated neighborhood, Meta Housing, who purchased the lot, says they will bring luxury high-rises to the area as well as provide 20% low-income housing. Stash Maleski is with Belmont Art Park United, a grassroots effort to combat Meta Housing's project. The group has petitioned the city council on numerous occasions, but Belmont belongs to Councilmember Ed Reyes' district. Reyes says he welcomes the building because it will provide some low-income housing. Maleski says that Meta Housing's project will simply displace the residents who have enjoyed the neighborhood and unofficial park for decades to make way for gentrification.
Luxury housing is going to dramatically affect this neighborhood in a much greater way than that 20% affordable is. This neighborhood's rents are going to essentially skyrocket. If this lot goes down, you're going to see the lots across the street go down. The other corner, you're going to see more and more of these developments because the developers are going to be attracted to this area and know that they can pretty much get away with anything they want.
Construction at Belmont has temporarily stopped until Meta Housing obtains the proper permits to demolish it. In the meanwhile, some neighbors are still organizing to stop the project, while many graffiti writers, Pelota Tarasca players, and train buffs are already mourning the loss of public space in L.A. Reporting from KPFK, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.